And hello, thank you so much for joining us. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, and as always, we're wishing you the best. And I want to send a shout out to one of our many listeners. This is for Christopher. Hi, Christopher. We were just on the phone, in fact, right when it was time to start the show, so we had to interrupt our private conversation, but hopefully you're joining us on air right now, actually online right now, on our podcast. And that's one of the fantastic things about PRN, Progressive Radio Network, because all our listeners can tune in live while we're on air. And our show is brought to you every Tuesday from 10 to 11 a.m. when we have our guests with us and we have a discussion about some aspect of natural living. And we have been actually addressing this topic, myself and Dr. Eugene Samprone, for many, many years. I began to do so in 1964. Yes, that is a six. And it really pays off, because when people pay attention to what they think, what they eat, and how they live, they have better health outcomes. And when they don't, unfortunately, they are setting themselves up for a long and winding road that, you know, does not seem to go in the right direction. And, of course, it's much more difficult to try to climb out of a hole than to protect ourselves from falling in one. But, nonetheless, fruits and vegetables are still the answer, regardless of how much problem that you have. If you go to a diet of all whole foods, organic brown rice, I know that has been reported as being high in arsenic, but many of the organic growers, particularly in California, have now been changing growing habits to actually avoid a lot of the arsenic that had been in even the brown rice, even in the organic brown rice. But that's a good thing to eat, as well as steamed vegetables, cabbage, kale, Swiss chard, collard greens, berries such as raspberries, blueberries. All of these things can help enhance circulation, clean out the veins and arteries, increase cellular oxygenation, and lead to feeling fantastic. So that's what you want to do. Now, you can always reach us at naturalnurse.com or also at Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And we're so happy that we have over about 145,000 listeners that have been tuning into our podcast, and we really support that and are happy that you're enjoying the show, and we want to hear from you. Today, we have as our guest Mr. Paul Strauss. Paul, who was originally born in New York City, but then he became really a country boy, he received his first inspiration for his mission in life as a young boy after spending summers in the country. And early in life, he met a teacher in New Mexico who taught him about the Shoshone way of life and their view of nature. He also studied plants on the Hopi and Navajo reservations, and I did that as well. Adding to his studies of the West, he spent time in the Sycamore Canyon Wilderness area, as well as the Superstition Wilderness area in Arizona. Paul Strauss is the land steward of a wonderful organization, the United Plant Savers, and he is the steward of the United Plant Savers Botanical Sanctuary. He is a farmer, herbalist, and beekeeper, and he emulates the life of the green man. From seed to harvest to product, he works intimately with plants, and he is the owner of Equinox Botanicals, a small herb business. Paul grows most of what he uses to manufacture his botanicals. He has lived on his farm for 40 years, and on today's show we will also be talking about Paul's book, The Big Herbs, The Use and Abuse, Natural History and Identification of Major Tree and Shrub Species in the Midwest and Eastern U.S. So thank you so much for joining us today, Paul.
Glad to be here.
And I know that you've been involved in natural life, really, most of your life, but you actually started out being a city boy, being born in New York City.
That is correct. I have memories of that as my youth, yes, and all the noise.
Well, some people thrive on that noise, and some people like to get away from it. But What did you, you know, what kind of lifestyle did you have as a child? Were your parents interested in natural living at all?
Not at all. Didn't even talk about it. It's not something that was ever present. They were of the generation coming out of World War II that was time to build families and get a job, get an income, and the world was looked at very differently than it is now.
That's true. But yet, you stepped out of that, what might have been, you know, your prescribed destiny to what was your true destiny. So how did you feel, yeah, how did you feel inspired to become more of what you are today, a green man?
Well, I remembered with fondness and the calmness of what it was like living in the country. And my parents, once they got to middle class, I think I was a probably 6 years old, we were able to, every summer, move to the country for 3 months. And just what I felt, and working in the gardens, and being around a forest, and being around farmers, and living near lakes, and catching turtles and frogs, that's where I felt better than I did my life in New York City, and it never left me, ever, ever left me.
And so that actually promoted your interest and allowed you to leave the city and create, yeah, and create what you do today.
Yes.
Now, tell us about the time that you were studying the Shoshone way of life.
Well, there was a point after I left New York. I spent a year in Boston thinking maybe I should go to college and find something I liked. And what was happening in those years, that was 67, 68 in those years, there was a war raging. I considered an illegal war, and I had a lot of friends coming home in body bags, and I didn't do much schooling at all.
Basically. So you're talking about the Vietnam era.
That is correct, yeah. And it just made me realize what governments can do and what they can tell people to do, even if it's not correct. And it was a formative time for me, standing up and doing what I think was right, and it certainly wasn't going to school. It was basically trying to tell people in protest that what I considered an illegal war. The same summer that I was doing that, I had to work. I had a job on an extreme psychotic ward, which was a locked ward at Boston State Hospital, which really opened my eyes to the type of pressures people are put on by their families, by their government. I had access to the record of these people, and so many people were warped by all that stuff. And the end of that summer, I took a vacation and just happened to be at Woodstock. After that
summer.
You mean
the town of Woodstock?
That's the Woodstock Music Festival in the town of Woodstock, that's right. And after that summer and my experiences, there was absolutely no way I could ever live in a city again. And a couple friends and I decided to take a trip, the classic trip every New York kid wanted to take, to get out to California. And exactly what we did, and we headed out west. And it was a great trip down the coast of Florida, camping out in the Everglades, seeing things I'd never saw, seeing nature I'd never seen, and came up through Texas and met a guy hitchhiking. Knew about the town of Taos, New Mexico, and said we should go there. And we said, if you think we should, we will. And we went there, and Taos at the time was very different than you find it today. The ski slopes weren't developed. The huge artist circles were not there yet. It wasn't a destination for vacationers at that point. But it was filled with three different cultures, from white to Chicano to Native people. It was just an incredible place for me to land, and had a gathering one of the first or second nights we were there. We were invited to a party at Magic Mary's house. Magic Mary raised lions on a vegetarian diet. Pretty interesting
really?
Place. Yeah. I didn't understand it, how that was possible. But
well, that's really odd, because I have seen many cats pass away who lived with vegans. So I'm wondering about that with a lion. That's incredible. I imagine perhaps some cats make it, but I have seen many that don't, unfortunately.
I would agree with you, and I didn't get to really talk to her about how all that happened. But anyway, at that gathering, I noticed, obviously, a First Nation man, Native guy, and we started talking, and I think he looked right through me and saw what I was after and asked me if I wanted to study with him. I said, I'll tell you the next day, and by the next morning I pulled my backpack out of the car, told my friends to go on to California. I was staying in Taos, New Mexico, and he really became my first teacher to help me understand what it meant to live outdoors, to lead a life based solely on nature, to finally start getting my herbal skills. I'd been studying herbalists on and off for a year, even in Boston. And it was an amazing opportunity, and I guess I'd forever be thankful to him and his family for taking me in and setting me on the road. I had a bad cold when I'd met him because we were camping out at a hot spring. It was actually the Easy Rider hot spring there, a very famous hot spring, and living a three-walled adobe shack and cold night temperatures. And he said, I'll tell you what, Paul, come out on the desert with me. I'm going to give you your first lesson. And day or two later, he took me out in the desert in the evening, and made a little nest around some sagebrush, started up a fire, started talking. Talking was so easily done with him. And first thing he did was, once we had the fire going, was cut sagebrush and put it on the fire and started it smoking. Put me closer to the fire, covered my head with a blanket, and just told me to inhale. Well, that was the first herb I really ever used, and it was being used by a man I loved instantly, and right away I knew this is a person I needed to be with, and this is a life I needed to investigate. And it was. It really, really was. And from that point on, every day with this man was a different herb, a different way of looking at animals, a different way of finding plants, either up a mountain or down low near, on the riverbeds.
So you really became the apprentice to a medicine man, which many people,
I guess. I don't know if I would be that glorious about that. I was more his student, not just an apprentice. Since I do have apprentices on and off now, I wasn't really working for him, splitting his firewood. I always helped with everything, but he had taken me in. He was the father I never had. I met others coming down the road to where I am now, but it was an amazing thing to happen to a young man. I think I was 18 at the time.
That sounds fantastic. And so that was inspirational. And
yes.
Spent
how long
in that particular life area?
I lived in the Taos region with this man and his family, and there were other great herbalists I met at the time. Other native people had taught me about plants for about 6 to 8 months. So it was probably around 7 months, and I started getting real antsy, and I didn't really know why, but I felt that it was time for me just to find my next destiny, and he understood that, and I knew I'd always be back to see him. There was no such thing as cell phones or staying in touch in those days, and again, pulled my backpack out of his house and thanked him. Hit his head out on the road and stuck out my thumb. And way down the road, I saw a couple long-haired guys in a green panel van looking perplexed at their rear tire because it was flat. And they really couldn't bust the lug nuts. And kind of walked down the highway, asked them how they're doing, where they're going, and can I give you a hand? And I was able to break their lug nuts, fit their tire. And they said, we're heading back to Athens, Ohio, which is a small college town around near where I live. And I said, what's that place like there? And are there any herbs there? How about a forest? And they said, well.
So you had already developed now an interest in medicinal plants.
Not just an interest. I knew it would be a major part of my life. That's one of the things that this teacher gave me in New Mexico. This is going to be part of my life. I need to be self-sufficient. I need to grow my own food. I need to be responsible for myself, my animals, and my community. And when they told me, you know, hey, there's forest around there, the next question I asked, because about 2 weeks before that I was studying the plants golden seal and ginseng, I said, you know if there's any golden seal and ginseng in those forests?
Talking about things that certainly are wonderful to find in nature, but are very difficult because they have been so over-harvested.
They have been. The bottom line is they have been over-harvested because of their financial value. And when I finally came back to this area around Athens in Meigs County, that wasn't so. I walked into forests that had the concentrations of herbs were so high. Everything from golden seal to ginseng to the cohosh and just all the plants I use now. And certainly now it has gotten more critical. I think with the advent of United Plant Savers and our botanical sanctuary, there's a lot more information out there. And certainly now most of those at-risk herbs can be cultivated in an organic means and relieve the pressure from the wild, which is really needed. But this area I moved into in Meigs County here in southern Ohio was just an amazing herbal resource. It's certainly one of the breadbaskets for medicinal and edible herbs.
Oh, it really is. I was hiking recently there, and I actually found what's called purple coneflower, also echinacea, just growing wild in the
field.
That's
right. Yeah. People around here, and just the community around here have, because this is the foothills of Appalachia, so there's a real herbal history. And all these people you meet remember their grandmothers, their grandfathers. Take them out to find ginseng. They had a sore throat. They tell them that you golden seal. It was actually part of the history of the area I decided to move into. And then, of course, when I found out how reasonably priced farms were, I was pretty much stuck and in a good place and knew, I think I knew, maybe I'm saying it too easily, but I really felt this was going to be my home. And that's really what happened. And it wasn't long after I found this area, I met the next person who was the father I never had, and that was my first friend I call my physical plane teacher, and his name was Bill Klonch, who just gave me every piece of information I needed to lead the life I wanted to lead.
And he was a farmer in Ohio?
He was a farmer. He had grown up over the hill before I bought the farm I bought, and he farmed this whole farm, raised in a family of 13 kids, never had a car. The mother was an herbalist and a midwife, birthed all her own kids at home. They grew all their own food. He had everything I needed in terms of information. He taught me how to make a living in the woods, how to build harness, how to farm with a team of mules, how to grow food in an Appalachian way, what every piece of wood in the forest could be used for, no matter what species. It seems like my whole road has led me to where I'm going, and everyone I met along that road had changed my life.
And well, I want you to hold that thought, which is so wonderful, sharing the story of how you began, and mm-hmm. we will continue our discussion. You've done so many incredible things, writing a book, creating a movie called Sanctity of Sanctuary, beautiful name, and mm-hmm. we will continue our discussion with author and herbalist Paul Strauss and his Equinox Farm when we come back. Right now, you can listen to the Natural Medicine Chest, and we'll be right back with more.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss Sar sarsaparilla or Smilax officinalis.
Sar sarsaparilla is a tropical plant which grows in South America, Mexico, and Guatemala. Although most Americans are familiar with it as a flavor enhancer for root beer, it has also been used for its beneficial properties for hundreds of years by many different cultures. In Roman times, the young shoots were eaten, and the mature vines were worn as garlands at festivals of Bacchus. According to ancient Roman writings, Sar sarsaparilla originated when the beautiful maiden, Smilax, was turned into a shrub after her love was slighted by the young crocus.
Sar sarsaparilla was brought to Europe in the 16th century by Spanish traders. A French physician, Nicolas Monardus, published a comprehensive account of Sar sarsaparilla as a treatment for syphilis in 1574. During Portuguese military operations in 1812, a British inspector general of hospitals noted its positive effect on syphilis patients. It has also been used in China for treatment of the same condition. Sar sarsaparilla was included in the United States Pharmacopoeia until 1950 as a recommended treatment of secondary syphilis.
Sarsaparilla's medicinal action appears to be a result of binding bacterial endotoxins in the gut, thereby decreasing their absorption. This greatly reduces the stress on the liver and is likely responsible for its historic use as a tonic and blood purifier.
In a controlled study of 92 patients published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1942, a chemically active component of sarsaparilla called sarsaponin greatly improved psoriasis in 62% of the patients and resulted in complete clearance in 18%. Sarsaparilla is often recommended by naturopathic physicians for gout, arthritis, and psoriasis. Another folkloric use for sarsaparilla is as a tonic for male sexual potency.
So, if you want a root beer flavored tea with a long history as a healthy tonic, reach for the sarsaparilla in your natural medicine chest.
And welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us today right here on the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z on Progressive Radio Network. And if you're listening live, you know we have a wonderful guest today, and his name is Mr. Paul Strauss. We're talking about his journey into the natural life. And it's inspirational to find that wherever you are today, you can move towards integrating more of natural therapies into your life. And if you'd like to find out how, you can visit our website at naturalnurse.com. And there's all kinds of articles there. There's also books that Dr. Zamperone and myself have written. Click on books, as well as the many radio shows that we do, including The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, right here on Progressive Radio Network. And after each show, they are archived, so you can send your friends and relatives, and you can actually download them if there's something you particularly want to hear a bunch of times or has some specific information that you want to remember. You can always download the shows. That's a wonderful service provided by Progressive Radio Network. And today, we're going to continue our discussion with Mr. Paul Strauss. He is the author of The Big Herbs, The Use and Abuse, Natural History and Identification of Major Tree and Shrub Species in the Midwest and Eastern U.S. Paul, we had a discussion already about some of your earlier life and what led you to the Southern Ohio foothills, where you purchased and have owned a farm and been quite self-sufficient for over 40 years. And what led you to write this book specifically on trees and shrubs rather than the smaller medicinal herbal plants that I know you are also familiar with?
Well, it didn't take me long to realize a lot of the understory herbs that we use. We've already talked about golden zeal and ginseng and the cohoshes are there because of the beautiful shade of the canopy of our hardwood forests. So these herbs wouldn't even be there without the forest. And a lot of people know how to use wood products, but not that many people know how valuable these trees are for so many reasons. They clean the air, they give us oxygen, they hold the soil, they're beautiful, and they give us amazing products that we can use. And that is from products from baseball bats to tables, but also medicine and food. And I thought, there are a lot of people concentrating on how to use our woodland herbs and field herbs, but I was so familiar with the forest, and it's really my home. I live in the forest almost every day going out for some reason or another, and I thought this is a topic I should take on. Now, unlike a person who's a real author who has time, it's not like I have that much time to write. It took me a while to do this. It actually took over 7 years, and the only reason I was able to do that I've been lucky enough after 12 years on the farm to be able to get away from the farm for a month, and that was really good for me because I got to see the other ecosystems, other life forms, and those are the times I got to write and think. I don't have time on the farm. I'm too busy, and a lot of farmers will tell you that. So that month, I often spent time in Hawaii. I have a large group of friends that lives there. Most of them are farmers and naturalists. Often spend time on my friend's ethnobotany farm. I spend time on an organic avocado and coffee farm. And I got to intimately know the Big Island of Hawaii, and it's an amazing place and has a lot to offer, and, of course, took up surfing. I was offered a caretaking job at one point to be caretaker of a beach area called Makalevena that was put aside by the Bishop Estates for the benefit of the Hawaiian people. The caretaker was there, was a friend, and he was having an operation. I got the opportunity to live there on that beach, four different beaches. Turtles every day, whales go by every day, pods of dolphins every day, and after I stuffed myself with the ocean, there I was with no chores, no job, no animals to feed, and I could finally sit down and start writing. It took over 7 years to do it, not even that big a book, just a ton of information in it, and that's really the way it happened.
Well, that's a great story. So you got to write the book because you found yourself with a little time, and you decided to focus on trees because you felt there was quite a bit of information about the smaller plants, but not so much in terms of the trees.
It also gave me this great opportunity to write down some of the stories, adventures, mishaps, mistakes of this life that I'm leading, because I find out that so many people are interested in this life but really don't know how to get there. And those stories, I find, bring people into this life. It amazes people that people could live like this. Many people go hunting and fishing in a supermarket. Well, you don't have to do that. And I don't know, the more people that live in the country, the better world it's going to be, is my feeling. There seems to be a sanity here I never felt in cities, never do feel in cities. But every morning I wake up, I get to do my chores, feed my animals, go to work for the benefit of the world and myself and my community, and it just seems like the right thing to do.
Now, what about your involvement with United Plant Savers? Because I have lectured several times at Rosemary Gladstar's various herbal conferences. I've been doing herbal medicine since 1964.
All right.
And I've written 12 books, in fact, on herbal medicine, but none specifically on trees, although I have included discussion of trees and the medicinal and spiritual aspects of trees in many of the books, but not with a real focus, which I really enjoyed about your presentation. And how did you get involved with United Plant Savers, which is such a worthwhile organization?
Truly is, and I'll tell you the story because you know Rosemary. Rosemary came down to the area I live in, the farm, and was going to teach a course with me. And we had a 2 or 3 day course. I think we have 15 or 20 students. And of course, I don't teach in a classroom. I teach in the woods, and that's where Rosemary prefers to teach. It was the first time that I'd met her, and she's a great lady, easy to get along with, brilliant, and has done so much for the herbal movement in the United States. And just at the time I met her, she was starting to think about and organize United Plant Savers. That was an original seed from her head. And I must tell you, this is an herbalist who's traveled far and wide, much farther than I. I've been pretty localized in Appalachia for the herb work I do. And on one of the hikes we were taking on the property that is the property that came to United Plant Savers Botanical Sanctuary, I had to buy that property because it was going to be lost, and it has huge amounts of diversity, including one of the largest golden seal patches anyone has ever seen in the world. And on that walk, about an hour or two into the walk, I noticed that Rosemary was missing. Now, I knew Rosemary was having a great time, totally amazed, and I looked at the class. Anybody see Rosemary? And I looked around. She was gone. Said, listen, I'm going to go back this trail. I'm going to try to find Rosemary. She's one of our teachers. I feel responsible for her. Walked back on the trail about 2 or 3 minutes, and then right in the area that I've named Hydrastis Heaven, because it's 4 acres of golden seal there, I see this crazy sight. I see a black head of hair, beautiful black head of hair, leaning over like she was being totally engulfed by the golden seal. Now, isn't that perfect for Rosemary Gladstar? And I walk up to Rosie and say, Rosie, what's going on? And I must have copped a little attitude, you know, because the class was going on. I felt responsible. Rosemary looks at me with these beautiful, dark, tear-stained eyes, and she says, Paul, do you know what you have here? And I look around, yeah, I got a lot of golden seal here. And she said, I have never seen such a treasure as this area, this farm. Would you be willing to be on the board of United Plant Savers? So that's how I started. And then it was only about half a year later, Rosemary and I and another dear friend and naturopath, Richard Liebman, who now has an organic farm in Hawaii, said, this farm will be, and that's what we made it, the first botanical sanctuary in the United States, totally dedicated to at-risk medicinal herbs. Like you said, those herbs that are often harvested out of the forest, financial gain, not necessarily their medicinal value. And that was the start of my friendship with Rosemary, and that was the start of the botanical sanctuary. And I also was able in that time, because I was mostly in Appalachia, meet a lot of my Western herbal hero herbalists who I'd read and studied about, and yet a lot of those people made this sanctuary possible. So many herbalists put their energy together to get the sanctuary happening, and it happened, and it's an amazing place. And now we have two internships a year there, and remarkable farm.
That's so great. So now you actually work in conjunction with Rosemary moving forward with the whole organization of, which is a great organization, and that is Plant Savers. That's one of the things that you gave us as a contact. So if people want to find out more, they can go to unitedplantsavers.org or listen to the show or go on the archive and get the link directly there.
Yes. So again, it's like my life has been moved forward as I meet different people to keep moving wherever it's moving me. And after that, what happened, kind of sad story, I realized one day as I was sitting at a cabin I built, right on the first pond I built, and I was sitting there after a long day of work and only glad to sit down and get a swim, and I heard right behind me in the woods that form some of the water system for that beautiful pond, someone starting to log.
Oh,
in
no.
1 second, I
Wait
realized...
Wait a minute, is this on your land?
This is now on my land.
Huh.
Yes. And they're not logging on my land, but at that point I had an 80-acre farm, so there's another 100-acre farm that joins it.
Next to it, yes.
Private land is sacred. Landowners can do what they want, even if it's bad for the earth, and many do bad things for the gain of money. And I decided, because that was a lesson, that farm creates the water system that helps fill this pond with beautiful, clean water. Never been strip mined around there. There were strip mines further up the road, and I decided any piece of land that came up for sale around my farm, I would make it my responsibility to purchase and protect and make it part of this community in here. And that's what I set about doing, and it took a lot of years. And at one point, I found myself with over 600 or 700 acres, and there was just, it was financially difficult. It was a huge amount of work, besides I'm already farming an 80-acre farm, and I decided it's time to draw other people in. So I started asking a lot of my students, interns, friends, other neighbors in local counties, there's wonderful land around here, can be bought for very reasonable prices, it hooks onto my land, and that worked. And as of right now, there are almost 2,500 to 3,000 contiguous acres surrounding my farm and the United Plant Savers Botanical Center.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you got it protected just by having other people of like mind.
That's right. And I couldn't buy any more, so it was a brilliant idea that was out of desperation, I must tell you. I needed to further the cause, and I had to bring other people in who were also green who wanted this life, and it really worked wonderfully.
Oh, that's just wonderful. to create that, because you didn't wait for the government to do it. You didn't wait for the Nature Conservancy to come in, which it might have been too late. Not that they don't do good work, because here on Long Island, they are buying up a lot of old estates. When some of the elder, very wealthy people pass away and their children would just as soon sell it to a developer, the Nature Conservancy will step in, purchase the land, and then do what you did, which is maintain it in its totally natural state.
That's right. Nature Conservancy can only sell land also. I'm sure they do a good thing with that, but if they need a bigger piece, they can sell another piece. I felt better just doing it in the image that I was given by my teachers and what I needed, and I've been a member of Nature Conservancy for a long period of time, but this is something I didn't want to use the government. I didn't want to use the Nature Conservancy. I just used what I had, and that's what I did.
Now,
I don't trust using the government, by the way.
No, I know, and that's fine, because you're making your own statement.
Yes.
But also, you were able to maintain this land. Now, could it still be sold to others that may not share your vision of maintaining the natural forest?
The Botanical Sanctuary can never be sold, the UPS Botanical Sanctuary. My farm will never be sold. It will be given to my daughter, who's studying with me now and becoming an herbalist.
That's
all
excellent.
My friends around me have exactly the same green ethic. None of them would ever log their land for money. The only way we log is when storms drop trees and they're in our roads. So I can almost guarantee the universe that almost everybody that lives around me in this green community would rather cut their wrist off than sell their land to a logger or someone who's not going to take good care of it. That's the advantage of good neighbors who lead green lives.
And with that, this is a handshake agreement rather than any kind of contract.
That is correct.
And it's working well so far, which is wonderful.
Yes.
And then the natural plants that you found there when you got there, a lot of them have been not over-harvested, so I imagine you still have some golden seal on your land.
A lot. A lot of golden seal, a lot of rams,
you know,
a lot
I have tried to grow both golden seal and ginseng many times, mm-hmm. and I have not been too successful because apparently not only do humans love and honor it, so do squirrels and deer.
Yeah, well, not anything. Deer, groundhog, nothing's eaten golden seal. Believe me, I've never seen golden seal being nipped or munched. I've seen where a dog has scratched it. Ginseng, on the other hand, you bet. Deer love it.
I know.
You need just the right soil to raise these plants. You need a soil that's really fertile and high in calcium and magnesium, and that's what this property has around here. We have an underlayment of limestone under the topsoil that provides for those herbs.
Have you ever seen that snake formation, which is not that far from where you are?
Been there many times. That's Serpent Mound.
Yeah, I've been to Serpent Mound many times because the United States Psychotronic Association often had their yearly conference close to it, about an hour or two away, and I would always go out there. So this is a beautiful, that whole area of Ohio is still just so beautiful.
It is, and it's not very well known, and some of the most formative and largest earth mounds on the planet are right around us.
So what would you suggest that people focus on if they want to bring more of, like what you're talking about, a green energy into their life? You might not be watching TV too much, but there seems to be a whole plethora of TV shows right now on various people who live a very natural lifestyle.
Like
one man who's up in the, sort of not Oregon, but I guess it's north of Seattle several hours. Near Orcas Island in the rainforest there, and he just lives completely in the woods. I don't know if you ever saw that show. So he's somebody I would call a green man. I imagine you would.
He is a green man if he's living in the woods. Yeah. And there are more and more people. There's more awareness coming to this as the Earth is having more and more problems, basically because human beings have abused it. I don't know. A lot of people still don't believe in climate change and global warming, although their eyes better be snapped open here. But there is a group of people that know this is happening and want to affect changes and try to help this incredible green planet. And it's good other people are out there talking about it now and that there are opportunities to do something to help the world. You know, you don't even have to have a big farm like this. As a matter of fact, if you live in a city and have a half an acre, that doesn't mean on the west and north side of your house you couldn't have golden seal and ginseng. It doesn't mean you couldn't dig up your lawn and put in a prairie or gardens. And what great effect might you have in a local community? I mean, this work can be done almost anywhere.
Well, we're going
to
take another break right here,
cities,
Paul. We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion. We will talk about Equinox Farm and Equinox Botanicals and, you know, how you created some of the formulations that you share with others, what the thought process was in terms of those combinations and some of the activity of the herbs that you use. So we will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. You can join us every single Tuesday. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse. You are joining us right here on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. And today we have as our guest a very interesting person. His name is Mr. Paul Strauss. And he's written a book called The Big Herbs, an inspiring story of a young New Yorker who came to Appalachian, Ohio, way back in 1970 to live on the land and who has created since a 3,000-acre botanical sanctuary and a nationally known center for the study and practice of botanical medicine. In 40 years of recovering strip-mined land, Paul Strauss has created a sanctuary and parcel of paradise, as well as Equinox Botanicals, which now serves people all over the world who wish to understand, gather, and use natural medicines that are grown in the wild. So thank you so much for being our guest today, Paul.
Yeah, pleasure.
Now, I want to talk about some of the things you've put together.
Okay.
For instance, on your website called Equinox Botanicals, people can see that, and you have so many different things. We talked about United Plant Savers. On your website, you also have a movie that you made. Tell us a little bit about your movie.
Well, I couldn't call it my movie. I would say I'm the protagonist, and it is about me and the journey I've taken. There's a nice little university around here in Athens, and I have a friend that was a film producer there, Bliss DeVall. And when Bliss first started coming out to the farm and swimming at the pond and seeing this life, she said, you know, Paul, I'm going to make a movie about you. And she'd already made some wonderful movies for public television, and I'd seen some of them. So she was a pretty nice person and really did good work, even outside her university professorship. And I said, well, I'm ready. When you are, let's see what happens. And then she had found a time and had the opportunity to make a movie, and it came to play, and it, too, took 7 years to make because she was a mother, professor, didn't have that much time. I was teaching, running a farm, and doing all the assorted things I've been doing. And it took that long to produce this movie. Bliss did a wonderful job figuring out the movie, the editing. It's actually quite a beautiful film. It goes into some of the more personal areas of my life, and I wasn't comfortable with that at first. But after a while, it's just part of life, and we all go through uncomfortable times and hard times. So I became comfortable with it and actually really liked the movie. Has little vignettes of my mother talking about me growing up in New York, and Rosemary is involved in that movie, and a lot of other great herbalists are, and has a lot of the story of forming the sanctuary and what I had to learn from my physical fame teacher, Bill Claunch, who really sent me on this road to living this life in Appalachia. And it's won several awards. It's won the environmental award at the International Film Festival in Byron's Bay. And the year after it came out there, I had some interns from Australia. So that's very cool. And, you know, between the book and the movie, it's just another way to get the thought out there that there's another way to lead this life. There's another way to help the earth. And here are some of the ways. Check the movie out. Check the book.
Yeah, it's wonderful. There's a link to it right on your website, I believe.
Yes, there is.
In terms of the movie. And I want to talk about some of the formulations you have put together also at Equinox Botanicals.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, you have something that people can put on their skin, and it's
yes.
called Hemp Aid. So I'm interested in how you came up with this formulation.
Okay. The Hemp Aid came out of a product I made that's called the Golden Healing Salve. The Golden Healing Salve, which the FDA told me I can't use the word healing, that's a whole other story, but all the products I made initially were for me to use. Here's a kid who's 18 years old, learning how to use a mule, chainsaw, run a stick shift, build fence, take down fence. In other words, myself and my mules were constantly wounded. Didn't have much money. Every money I had was going to put the $100 a month for the mortgage on the farm. So I said, well, basically put up or shut up, Paul. You've got to start making medicines for yourself. You've got this knowledge. Knowledge is worth nothing unless you can prove it, and it works. So the first product I made was the salve, and lo and behold, it did everything it needed to do. It guaranteed I never had infections from some of the wounds I had. It speeded the healing time by 50% because of the herbs used. And then out of that product, which we still sell, we decided to use hemp oil. So there's the same product made with hemp oil.
Well, let me ask you this. There's some very interesting things that you're using in these combinations.
Yes.
Some are well-known things, but tell me about Gilead Bud.
Balm of Gilead Bud.
Yes.
Yes. Balm of Gilead has been used for tens of thousands of years for many things. Wound healing, respiratory conditions, just a plethora of stuff. It grows. It's not an at-risk plant. It's everywhere. It grows from northern Ohio up into Alaska, Siberia, like moist, wet areas. It's easy to gather. The secret with Balm of Gilead is that the leaf buds of Balm of Gilead are absolutely coated with one of the most remarkable natural healing products there is, not a product, a natural item, which is propolis. And propolis is the gum resin that honeybees gather to use as their glue, bee glue, so us beekeepers know it as, but also it's used to help keep the hive healthy. In other words, if a queen bee lays an egg, that egg hatches out before they'll even allow the queen to go back and lay an egg in that cell. Nurse bees come along with a propolis rag and clean out that whole cell, disinfect it with propolis. So the key to Balm of Gilead is the amount of propolis it has.
And that the bees would normally be gathering it.
That's right. That's right. And you can just use the leaf flower, the leaf bud.
And it's a tree that's, or a bush, more like.
It's a shrub, yes.
It's not a big, big tree, but it's
populous, so it's related to a cottonwood. So if you know the cottonwood species, you can also see the propolis on the unopened leaf buds of cottonwood also, which is another place to get that medicine.
So the best time to gather that plant would be before the buds open.
Correct. Early spring of the year. And you can just smell. Propolis has a wonderful, sweet, earthy smell. When a plant's producing that propolis and that leaf is not open, you can just smell it all around the plant.
So that's because I don't see that very often in the marketplace in terms of in salves, even in natural ingredients. So that's
well, you know, being a beekeeper has certain advantages to being an herbalist and a farmer. They all seem to hook up together. And because I've been keeping bees for a long time, because I decided to stop eating sugar in 1971, obviously I became a beekeeper, I learned about all the different products in the beehive. So propolis was pretty obvious to me to learn how to use. Not an easy plant to use, one of the hardest things to use in an apothecary, because it's really gummy, hard to clean up.
Right.
You have to know how to use it, but I rely on it every day.
And it stays mixed into the salve mixture, which, by the way, you don't seem to have any kind of toxic chemicals or preservatives in this formula.
Nothing I eat, nothing I grow, nothing I do knowingly has any toxic in it at all.
And do you find that it's stable over time in terms of the growth of microorganisms?
Exactly right. I've never seen it happen. If you pick up a jar 7 to 10 years later, you might smell the oil just changing its taste, because the oils I use in it are coconut oil, olive oil, a little bit of safflower oil, and, of course, beeswax, which is the thing that congeals the salve. That's it, but it seems to be effective for years and years and years, and I think it's held stable by the golden seal, the propolis, and all those wonderful oils in there.
Yeah, it looks just so completely natural. Really great. And then, of course, you have yellow dock root. We use that quite a bit. We use that for pregnant women.
That's right.
To increase their iron, which is wonderful. And calendula flowers, which is so well known for their healing capacity in terms of skin health.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, now, did you have any trouble with the comfrey root? Because when you talk about the FDA, we used to offer a lot more comfrey root, and then we had problems with that because of the FDA.
Yeah, we have had problems with the FDA, because the FDA goes overboard in certain areas. I know they're necessary, certainly for some, to protect the population from bad drugs. But certainly natural products are not bad drugs. And, you know, this is the thing with comfrey. I understand, and I actually know people, when finding out the wonders of comfrey, actually take in, make too much tea, too much capsules of comfrey, and it started blowing out their livers. It had an adverse effect internally in large amounts. Well, first of all, I use propolis in the salve, so it's external. It's not put in the body. I'm using plant-based products that have been used for tens of thousands of years and proved effective. So the FDA, and now because I've sold some products in Europe and Australia, they won't even allow comfrey to be used in external products.
I know
myself,
that.
I think it's a joke myself. I've certainly been proved to myself and all the people around here that it's perfectly safe to use externally, and I tend to like to use it in respiratory conditions too, in small amounts, in combination with other herbs. Because comfrey has a chemical in it called allantoin, and you got to love this word, is a cell proliferant. It speeds the healing time of cells.
Well, you know what? Thank you so much for that, Paul. But we have run out of time, but you've been a wonderful guest. And I want to remind our listeners they can find you many places, such as Equinox Botanicals, the Sanctity of Sanctuary.com, UnitedPlantSavers.org, GoldenSealSanctuary.org. You have done a tremendous amount of excellent work in your life, sharing your information, and I'm so glad you are doing that through your books, such as The Big Herbs, through your movie, through your products, through your botanicals. And thank you very much for your service to the earth and others.
Ellen, I appreciate you for your work, too, and it was a pleasure being with you today. Thank you.
And thank you, listeners. And as always, Dr. Eugene Zamperona and I Always hope that you stay healthy, and you can always join us by visiting naturalnurse.com or Facebook The Natural Nurse. You can also join us in person as we take people out onto the land to gather, identify, and make your own medicines. So until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.